accession number 20496, reel 3.
Edwin drew reel 3.
Yes, Wimpy Winsley was buried at sea two days later. Sad because he was his marriage had broken up and he was a likeable fellow. I found him a great support to me. On one occasion, we took Australian troops back from the Middle East back to Fremantle in Australia. There was it was just about the time the Japanese had declared war. And that was the first time I'd been in Australia, where we came up with the American Navy. Previously, we'd brought Australian convoyed the Queen Mary and the Queen Elizabeth, full of Australian troops. We brought them up from the Cocos Islands into Trincomalee in Sri Lanka, and then onwards up into the Red Sea. We just steamed at 28, 29 knots all the way, because they were perfectly capable of that speed. And the interesting thing, however, was that at Aden, you enter the Straits of Bab el-Mandeb, and through the straits there was a fairly narrow mine swept channel, and we took these two ships up into the Red Sea at a speed of something like 28 knots, line ahead through this narrow channel. And I remember going up on the quarter deck at night while we were going up through the straits, and immediately astern of us, and I was looking up, was the bows of the Queen Elizabeth, some quarter of a mile astern of us, and then astern of the Queen Elizabeth was the Queen Mary. And I thought to myself at that time, well, if we had had a failure, or if one of the ships had had an engine failure, there was no way in which one ship would not have just gone straight into the ship ahead. Frightening. So that carries me now through to really the time when the entry of Japan into the war. Whenever we could, officers were off watch, would sleep on the quarter deck at night. And I say whenever we could, because you had to, the only hope of engineer officers of doing that was if you had the first watch, which was from 8 in the evening till midnight. You came off at midnight and then you were free until 5:30, when dawn action stations. So we had 5 hours which we could sleep on the upper deck in the open air and in the cool. And on the morning of December the 7th, 1941, a midshipman came round to waken the officers who were asleep on the quarter deck. And as he did so, he said, the United States has declared war on Japan as the result of the Japanese bombardment of Pearl Harbor. And that, as far as we were concerned, was probably the best news that we could have had, because until then, we were a very small number of ships trying to cover two or three oceans, and it wasn't easy. We eventually arrived in April, end of March 1942, in Colombo, and we then were instructed to join the Eastern Fleet, which was a fleet of ships, of which Admiral Somerville had been given command, with the idea of protecting the east coast of Africa from a Japanese invasion, in fact. The ships he were given, apart from, I think it was one aircraft carrier, which I think it was the Indomitable, he had one aircraft carrier, modern aircraft carrier, but the rest, we were the most modern ship he had, 1926. And he made the celebrated signal to us when we had all gathered together. There's many a fine tune played on an old fiddle. We carried out several days exercising with the fleet, and then we were detached. Cornwall and Dorsetshire were detached to return to Colombo to refuel. And then we thought we were due to return to the fleet. But according to other information which has been published since, there were other instructions that we were unaware of, and that was not to join the fleet. But anyway, that be that as it may, we returned to Colombo. We were in the process of refueling when the notice came of the Japanese fleet having been sighted, and we were instructed to, Cornwall and Dorsetshire were instructed to complete fueling and to rejoin the Eastern Fleet as quickly as possible. It takes 4 hours to get a ship ready for sea, a steam-driven ship. And so we had to get a ship ready in as short a time as we possibly could, at the same time as complete oiling, which we were able to do, and we set sail and we steamed to rejoin the Eastern Fleet some, I don't know, some 750 miles south of Colombo. The first evening out, we were spotted by Japanese reconnaissance. And the next afternoon, at about on the 5th of April 1942, at about 2:30 in the afternoon, we were attacked by we know now, dive bombers from five Japanese carriers, which were in the Japanese fleet. We hadn't reached the Eastern Fleet. They picked us off before we got there. And within half an hour, we had been sunk.
Can you tell me about your own memories of that?
Well, from the time we left Colombo, we were at action stations. So we were going from either damage control stations down into the engine room, or back from the engine room back to the damage control stations. I came out of the engine room after engine room and was relieved by an officer, Mike Edgar. And I came up and had two slices of fresh pineapple for my lunch, and then went back to my damage control station. And then I was instructed to relieve Mike Edgar in the after engine room again. And I don't know why I was instructed to do that, but anyway, I was. And when the action started, of course, we in the engine room, we were unaware of what was happening, but it appears that the dive bombers came out of the sun over the stern of the ship. And they were... The first that the ship was aware of this was, either ship was aware of this, was bombs dropping. And because there was no radar, neither Dorsetshire or ourselves had radar. I believed Dorsetshire had some early radar, but I'm not sure about that. Anyway, Cornwall certainly had no radar. And as far as I was concerned, in the engine room, the first thing that happened was there was an almighty bang, and debris came down the ventilation trunk, and which were in the forward part of the after engine room, over the what are known as the throttles, the two main valves, which one is used for going ahead and the other is used for letting steam in to go astern. Each of those is manned by a senior engine room artificer. Anyway, they, because of the debris that came down the trunking, the ventilation trunking, they came away from their station. Anyway, as soon as we got them back on the throttles, and that was that. Well, the next thing that happened was that there were a few more obvious hits, not in the after engine room, but we were being hit. There was no doubt about that. The next thing that happened was, we were hit in the after at the back of the after engine room, the stern, the after end of the after engine room. That was where I was on duty. All the lights went out, complete darkness, fire, flames, smoke, you name it. And I, in charge of the engine room, I instructed them to the lads to get out. By that time, the ship had a list, and it was obvious that we couldn't do anything in the engine room. We had no power or anything. So I instructed the lads to get out, and to do that, they had to go up a iron ladder, And the only way you could do it in the darkness was, of course, by shouting. They had to go up the ladder into the smoke, and the flames were all on the deckhead. So they had to go out through the smoke, through the flames, and get out. They'd all got out, they'd all gone, except I was the last one. I heard a scream down at the after end of the engine room, and I went back to see where it was, who it was, and what it was, in the darkness and the flames and smoke, and there was silence. There was absolutely no sound, no nothing. It was impossible. I realized then it was an impossible job for me to try to do anything. But I also realized that I was in an impossible situation. The flames had got worse, and I was then trapped, as I thought. Anyway, I realized that I had a duty to attempt to get out. Apart from my duty as an officer, I also had a bigger responsibility to my family. Anyway, I went up, I found the way back to the ladder and went up the ladder and kept going through the smoke and flames, and I got burnt around the arms and legs. Anyway, I got out and I found myself on the main deck, which was the one below the upper deck. By that time, the ship had a severe list to port. I then made my way to the companionway up onto the upper deck, and I couldn't walk properly then. I was sort of crawling my way out. Anyway, I was helped then. A marine came along and he grabbed me and helped me up the companionway onto the upper deck. Bombs were still dropping, and the amusing thing was that when I got on the upper deck, I found myself alongside another engineer officer, Archbold, by the name of Archbold, who was in the next cabin to me in the ship, and we'd been buddies together. He said he'd left £50 down in his cabin and he was going down to get it. Well, I was in no state to stop him physically, but I said, look, forget it. Anyway, he went down and our cabins were on the starboard side, so he came back in a few minutes presumably with his £50. Whereupon the skipper came walking down the ship. He was covered in blood, saying, "Abandon ship, no panic." So Archie helped me up to the high side of the ship, starboard side, because by that time the port side, she was down to the water level. And as you can imagine, a ship with 20-foot freeboard, she'd gone over so that she was 20 feet down, but the other side was up. We slid down the side of the ship, and my thought is, if I can get into the water, I'm safe. The fact that we were 750 miles away from Colombo or any land didn't seem to enter into it at all. The important thing was that I would be safe. I got into the water and was immediately covered with oil fuel. Over my head, my eyes, and everything. And it was so, the oil is so thick, oil fuel is so thick, that on the lids of your eyes, you couldn't, your eyes wouldn't open, your eyelids wouldn't open. And the only way you could do anything was to hold your head back and you could look down the ship. We'd been steaming at 28 knots. So the ship still had a lot of forward movement. And as we went over, so the ship moved along and there was sort of, we were strung out, as you might say. But I found myself being swung round, or as much as I tried to move away from the ship, I found I was being drawn round, and I suddenly found that the inner screw from the after engine room was still only half out of the water, and the screw, which was 14 foot diameter, was still turning as like a propeller in the wind, as you might say. The ship was still going on, the propeller was half in the water, and so that was turning. And I found myself being dragged into the slipstream of this propeller. And as I approached the propeller, the ship gave a lurch forward and the propeller lifted out of the water and I went underneath it. We were strung out in a long line because of the forward movement of the ship. So we weren't in a group. If the ship had gone straight down, we'd all been in a group. But we were just strung out in a long line, and so that you were on your own. I found myself near to a large bit of timber, which I found to be one of the mess deck tables. And I couldn't get onto it. It was like a large plank of wood in this wide, and you couldn't get onto it because every time you tried to, it just sort of went under. So I hung on to it. And I watched the ship, which was going further and further away from me. She came over onto a port side and then went down, and her stern came right out of the water and she went straight down. But before that, I'd watched the walrus, one of the walruses, floated off the catapult and was floating on the sea and fine. But then as the ship went over, the aerials came over, caught the wing and dragged the walrus down, so the walrus disappeared. One of the motorboats floated off. Many of the Carly floats had been cut clear, and so they were in the water. The next thing that happened was that somebody came along swimming towards towards the spot where the ship had sunk, because, as I said, one of the motorboats had floated off, And every time you came up on a wave, you could see the motorboat. Anyway, somebody came swimming past me, and it was happened to be the physical training instructor, petty officer. He said, "How about what?" He asked me who I was, and he said, "Well, I'm swimming onto the motorboat." He said, "I suggest you take it easy and follow me." So I did that, left my mess deck, and as soon as I left my mess deck, literally, as soon as I'd left the table, the mess table, I trod on a fish, and I was very quickly back holding on to my table. But by this time, you see, it would be 3 o'clock, something like that, or maybe a bit later. And darkness comes in on the tropics at about 7. It's pitch black by 7, very short twilight. And I thought to myself, well, this is no good. I better start swimming.
What do you think this fish was?
Pardon?
What do you think the fish was?
Well, I've no idea. Well, it was, there's plenty of large fish out, but I've no doubt it was a shark or something because there were a lot of bodies around. I swam, and I eventually, just as it was getting dark, I got to the motorboat where I found that the commander had taken charge of the motorboat. There were about half a dozen large Carly floats around with men in, and there was also one of the large timber fenders which we carried aboard to put over the side to protect the ship when a tanker came alongside, to maintain the distance between the ship and the tanker. And these were quite large bits of wooden structures. They were something, I suppose, about 10 foot long by 4 foot wide by about 4 foot deep, something like that, more, perhaps more. And there was one of these attached to this group. Anyway, I reported to the motorboat, and Commander Fair, the commander, said, "Right," he said, "you go and take over charge of that Carly float over there," which I did do. And there were so many people standing in a Carly float that the actual sausage of the float was about 2 feet below water level. So it looked as if there were 30 or 40 men standing up to their waists in the water. And that's the way it was. You could see fish. The water is so clear out there. You could, in the daylight, once the night was over, you could see fish actually swimming around.
How nervous did that make you?
Well, once I was in the Carly float, I felt quite okay. There was nobody who was particularly worried then. All night, people were seeing lights. It's remarkable. They'd say, "I can see a light, sir." And if there was one light spotted, I would think there would be 30 or 40 during the night. There were obviously stars that could be seen when you were on the top of a wave. The next day, this all happened, but as I've said, some 750 miles south of Colombo, so we were right on the equator. The next day, the sun came up, and we took whatever clothing we had and tore bits off and put those over.